Well, I think I'm breaking a record today, folks. I'm in the pulpit 2 weeks in a row without a hospitalization in between. Yay! Hopefully I am on track for the mending. And part of the reason to tell you that is long ago, before all the changes have taken place, before I had even been diagnosed with cancer, Linda and I had planned a vacation that is paid for and booked. So when you don't see us next Sunday, it's not because I am back in the hospital. It is because we are actually getting a vacation that has nothing to do with healthcare. So we're looking forward to that for those 2 weeks, and then we'll be back for 2 weeks in May when we'll have a lot of stuff happening and looking forward to seeing all of you at that point. And of course, I do want to extend the invitation to you that we indeed are having coffee fellowship and open house at the Parsonage following church today. We thought this would just be a nice opportunity for us to all get the chance to meet over there. My daughter Elizabeth has been hard at work cooking food because I told her, honey, I'm just not going to be doing that much to contribute to this today. But if you need to know how to get to the Parsonage, you simply go around the corner up Warner and you're right there. Head through the front doors. We're going to look forward to greeting you there and just having a delightful time there together. On a more serious note, I do want to talk with you a bit about some of the ongoing things that are happening in our United Methodist Church across the country. I'm not going to belabor you with all the stories. Many of you have seen some of the challenges that are in front of the church right now. And a lot was being held back until our judicial council met to determine whether what was called the traditionalist plan that was adopted by the special general conference was to be valid or not. Well, the judicial council came back with its decision, and it once again affirmed several parts of this that they said were unconstitutional, but unfortunately, from my vantage point, they found most of the plan to be considered constitutional. The unfortunate thing is that some of the most onerous parts of this plan, which impose extreme penalties upon clergy who want to work towards an inclusive church as well as congregations, are pretty much going to make it impossible down the road for our United Methodist Church Together. Annual conferences across our country are in the process of meeting to determine what is going to happen. And one of the provisions that's really important to know that the Judicial Council upheld, which was the other thing people were watching very closely, is a plan by where churches and annual conferences will be able to disaffiliate from the United Methodist Church. So friends, all I can say is we are entering into uncharted territory over these next years. I trust that God's grace is going to continue to be at work, and as I was talking with our friend here, John Holbert, early this morning, the 47 years of history of the United Methodist Church is a blip on the screen when it comes to Christianity in general. And I believe through all of this that God continues to be at work, and the work of this congregation is going to be continued to be blessed as it moves forward, because I really believe the world needs the message of a church that is inclusive and welcomes and embraces everyone. And that indeed is who Westwood United Methodist Church is. So I think it's a really going to be an important time for us to be in prayer, for us to use our intellect and to really watch and see what's going on. Already there has been a groundswell of people who have previously been silent that have said, while we do not all agree, this kind of thing is now intolerable. So it will be interesting to see what the affiliations are going to look like in the future. It's going to very much be in flux, and it should be very interesting at annual conference this year. And I can't say I have used the word interesting and annual conference in the same sentence for a very, very long time. So if you'd like to get more information, really the best place to go is our annual conference website. That information is easy to find. You'll see statements from our Western Jurisdiction Council of Bishops, who are all in agreement in their absolute opposition to the traditionalist plan and to the decision of the Judicial Council. It's times like this when I'm glad that we can be the local church, because that really is the most important part of all of this, isn't it? Will you pause with me now for a moment of prayer? May the words of my mouth and the meditations of all of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O God, for you are our hope, you are our resurrection, you are our redemption. Amen. Isn't it interesting how at the different points we experience in life that we are so often asked to have to change our foci? It's happening to us as a church, it happens to us as individuals. We find ourselves involved in discussions, situations, perhaps even our work, that because of the change going on is now going to cause us to have to use a different part of our intelligence, a different part of what we used before. One of the things I have been doing the last couple of weeks is to start culling through this massive library I have amassed in my office. In fact, I'll mention to you, there's going to be a table outside my office door for the next several weeks that's got lots of books on it, and you're welcome to take any of them with you, because I do not have room for them. Kind of one of those dilemmas that we have. But as I've been culling through all of these books that are in my office, the change of seasons in my life has been so evident. There are all the books in there that represented my life as a seminary student. Then there were all the books that were part of this library that were all about the 23 years of youth ministry and the essential things you needed to know in order to be able to do that work. I found volume after volume that were devoted to educational theory and teacher training and children's ministry, when that was the focus of my work in the local church. There's always been book after book on spiritual practices, spirituality, and large, large sections of the required theology and church history we're all expected to know. And more recently, the preaching resources are what we're expanding on the office shelves. So yes, I can clearly see the shifts, the changes I've experienced vocationally, and now I find myself on the threshold of another one. This new arena into which I go is not unfamiliar, but the conversations are going to be very different. I'll be focusing on a much different aspect of church life, which is going to more meld communications, theology, generosity, and numbers into the everyday. Numbers, boy, I got to go back to that now. And there's a definite shift that's going to have to take place in my brain, because a different part of it is going to have to be used. Well, I don't know about you, but every time I have had to make one of these shifts in my life, it is accompanied by a ton of doubt. Or perhaps, if I'm really honest, self-doubt. Now, doubt is that generic word that can be used to cover all kinds of things. We use it to cover unbridled fear, or feeling anxious about working with a different group of people in a different place with a different world culture into which I am now going to be injected. Those might just be a few of the things that I'm thinking when I say, I have doubt. Don't we all deal with doubt? We do. It's a rare one of us who hasn't experienced this when it comes to all the shifts and the twists and the turns that take place in our lives. Do you remember a time when you had doubt? Let's be real. Doubt is part of life, and we are not going to escape it. While doubt is ever present, it can also make for some real challenges when doubt is attached to conversations surrounding faith. Because you see, for some, doubt is the absolute antithesis of faith. Doubt is viewed as weakness, as something that is to be absolutely purged from the psyche. So much of the theology that we've developed over the centuries has been an attempt to organize our knowledge and our thinking in a way that might erase doubt, or at least might serve to corral in the discussion. One of the developments in Christianity to which we were all subjected in seminary was systematic theology. Systematics, as we used to call it in seminary, was an attempt to teach theology in a rational, organized way, which hopefully pointed people all in the same direction, minimizing doubt, or at least to give the illusion that we had minimized doubt in the process. Well, we know how well that's served us through the ages. It still seems that when two or three are gathered in Christ's name and there is disagreement, doubt, if you will, a new denomination is formed. That's how powerful doubt can be. And it really is too bad that so often our equation of faith leaves no room for doubt as being a part of that equation. I would suggest that doubt is an absolutely essential part of the calculation that leads to faith. If nothing else, our biblical record represents this concept of doubt. And when there was doubt, it was not the end of the world, so to speak. And that certainly was very true in our story that we heard in the Hebrew Bible about Abram and Sarai, as well as the gospel story about Thomas, one of the disciples. We might remember, thinking back to that story of Abram, that he, his family, had been following God's call, a call which had taken him and his wife away from Ur of the Chaldeans, far away from their homeland, and now they were leading the life of nomads. And part of the promise and the reason for doing that is that God would be offering them blessing, and what that blessing to be was to be offspring. Well, in the midst of this story, there was a lot of doubt. You see, Abram found the proposition that he and Sarai would have a child at their advanced age to be something that was absolutely preposterous, so much so that if you look in there at the text, it says he fell onto the ground laughing when God said, the two of you are going to have a kid. Abram thought that was a gut buster to end all gut busters. God's promise, it seemed to Abram, was absolutely too impossible to believe. It was outrageous. He was doubting that this was ever going to be able to happen. And you might have thought that this was going to be the end of the story, because after all, it didn't seem that laughing at God's face was something you wanted to do. In fact, you figured there were probably going to be some not so good outcomes of laughing in God's face, because you just didn't want to mess with God. But as we know in this story, it turns out it was okay. It was okay to doubt. It was okay not to believe that God was going to follow through. It apparently did not test God's patience. Perhaps it even proved that God had a sense of humor. As I'd like to say, the proof to me that God had a sense of humor is a Trojan having lived in your midst for 13 years here by UCLA. That's proof of a sense of humor. Another part of this story, if you read more into it, has Sarai rolling over in laughter at the possibility that she, at her advanced age, was going to have a child. So, friends, one of the things we take from this story is that doubt was a part of the equation of faith for Abram and Sarai. And it was part of the equation for their relationship with God. The doubt was not a bad thing. Then when we move into our gospel narratives, we have the story of Thomas. Thomas, who has been forever memorialized as Doubting Thomas. John's account of the resurrection, as we heard this morning, mentioned Jesus appearing to a group of the disciples, which did not include Thomas. And the drama, of course, in this little story was Thomas finally meeting up with the disciples And they're telling him that they had seen and experienced the risen Christ. They'd seen Jesus. And Thomas was questioning the validity of the whole thing. Now, let's be honest. How many of us here have felt like Thomas on lots of occasions? I will confess to probably being Thomas more often than about anything else. In fact, Thomas at that point was pretty graphic. He said to them, unless he saw the supposed resurrected Jesus alive and was able to stick his finger in the wounds in his hands and in his feet and in his side, he wasn't going to believe any of it. It was total nonsense. Then, of course, John tells us that Jesus appeared to Thomas. And we now have the interchange that happens between Jesus and Thomas. And we have that comment, blessed. Blessed are those who believe without seeing. Now, often that's being taught as kind of a bit of a critique being pointed at Thomas. But let's get some things clear here, folks. When this gospel was written, it was long after Jesus. The people that were part of John's community, not a one of them had ever seen Jesus. So this comment that John has in the gospel is affirming the fact that even though they had never experienced or seen the risen Christ, they still could believe and there was still blessing for them, even though they had not been physically present with Jesus. Now, if we go back to this interchange directly between Jesus and Thomas, I think Thomas probably figured that he was due the same as the rest of his peers. They got to see Jesus. They didn't have to believe without seeing. So when we look at this story and think about it, I don't think Jesus was condemning doubt. I think once again, we have an example of the equation that doubt is part of that calculation that eventually leads us to faith. What do you think? But as was the case in the much more ancient story from the Hebrew text, this turned out not to be the end of the story for Thomas, as we know. Jesus did not shun him. We know that Jesus did not criticize him, nor did Jesus condemn him. Thomas was not ostracized because he had questions. And all appeared to be just fine, even though there was doubt. So what might we take from these passages as we're looking at them, friends? Well, in both cases, doubt was expressed. More importantly, doubt was expressed face to face with the Holy. Think about that. Face to face with the Holy. And in both cases, there was still blessing. And so this is something I believe we've been trying to grapple with in the centuries following. And it really impacts who we are and where we are in the present day. Now, what I do want to clarify a little bit is rather than talking about self-doubt, which is another whole discussion and a whole different sermon, I really want us to focus a little bit more about doubt and faith and what really is at work in these things. So perhaps one of the questions we might ask ourselves is, why is there doubt? Why does it have to be this way? Well, I'd like to suggest that when you really think about it and we sit down and we try to understand the Christian faith, we are juggling some pretty difficult constructs. Think about all the things it is we are taught about the nature of God, the nature of people, the story of Jesus, how the story and the life of Jesus was interpreted by other people, and all of the various permutations that come out of this whole thing. When you think about it, in some respects, it is a complicated story that we have to juggle. And I believe the average person is right to have some questions when you're juggling those balls and really wonder. One of the good things, I believe, and I think an example of grace, is that as we move through life, more often than not, we do tend to gain some wisdom and we hopefully tend to gain some insight. And the insight that's so important is, what are the things that are really critical? And what are the things that perhaps we can let go of? Perhaps some of the things that really create doubt. Part of what I think we also get into trouble with this, and why we deal with doubt so many times, is that too often we modern Christians are very content to leave our faith development back at some period in our lives long ago. I like to talk about it of being a full adult trying to operate with a kindergarten faith. Do you know what I'm talking about? And I think what I've found is it doesn't work very well. At each stage in our life, we have a different experience of God. We have a different experience of faith. And for us to move from stage to stage, I think it involves doubt. It involves asking questions. And too often we stunt ourselves in our growth when we say there's nothing else to learn, that I don't need to revisit the story, that I don't need to rethink faith. There are some who would suggest that are really deep into educational theory and faith development, that we have to relearn the faith at least 7 times in our lifetime. That we have to reacquaint ourselves with the story all over again at least 7 times. And if we pause and we think about it and we ask ourselves the question, where am I in that? How many times have I actually actively pursued rethinking faith, starting from square one, and what it means for where I am right now? I know doubt can often be a crippling thing, but I think there's a real antidote to doubt that's there for all of us, and that antidote is asking questions. Asking questions, lots of questions. One of the reasons I was even willing to get involved in church as a young adult, and in the United Methodist Church in particular at that time, was because the clergy at the church I decided to affiliate with were not scared of questions. And I had a lot of questions. A lot of questions. Because I had not been so steeped in the faith. I certainly did not grow up in a family that was anti-faith. These were not issues that I had been grappling with. So there were lots of questions. And unfortunately, in too many instances, the response to those questions is to try to give you black and white answers. When really what should be happening is instead we're invited to go more deeply into the questions and see what's really at work. So you see, I believe the antidote to doubt and the fear that often comes with doubt is asking questions. And I know for me and in my faith journey, it's been absolutely critical to continue to ask those questions and to at various points in my life leave behind those things to which I held and clinged so dearly and realized God was leading me in a different direction. And that was no longer truth for me and my experience in my life of faith. I honestly believe that's partly, perhaps in a more major way, responsible for the dilemma in which we find ourselves today as a church. This is a place that invites questions. This is a place where you're happy to tell me if you don't agree with me, because I know over 13 years there are a lot of you that have told me about things you disagree with. But we can laugh about most of those disagreements, because those disagreements generally have not been about the really important things. But in too many places in the church today, it's all about absolutes. It's all about having to have black and white answers. And from my vantage point, friends, I believe that is why so many are abandoning the church. Because black and white answers don't work in a life that we know is gray more than anything else. So as I wrap this up today, one of the things I hope for this congregation and pray for moving into the future is that it continues to be a place that is not scared of doubt, that welcomes the question, that it's a place that can hold up Sarai and Abram and Thomas and their doubting and say, that's a path. That's a path to God. What do you think? Amen.